This tape is being made by the Tano Yukon Historical Society, Fairbanks, Alaska, on March 27th at the Chamber of Commerce Log Cabin Building. Our guest speaker this evening is Mrs. Clara Rust, who is the daughter of the pioneer editor of the Dawson and Fairbanks papers. Clara Rust.
Good evening. And I am Clara Hickman Rust. Of course, I was born Clara Hickman and Clara Louise Hickman. But after my father passed on, and knowing that he wasn't publicized very much when he was an old pioneer and taken the Klondike Nugget into Dawson, and seemed like everybody else but him were publicized on this paper, so I thought it would be nice to let people know what part he took in it. And so I sign my name now as Clara Hickman Rust, being a widow, and I think I'm fully I can do that without hurting anybody's feelings. And when I was about 7, 8 years old, my father, 7 years old, my father was a partner in a big printing company called the Metropolitan Printing and Binding Company. It was the corner of 3rd and Main Street in Seattle. And about a catacorner of that building, it was cut, sliced across in just like a diamond shape, or not a diamond, a triangle shape. That building is cut across now. It still stands there. It was built specially for the Metropolitan Printing and Binding Company, and in 1906, and they were the largest printing company in Seattle. They had large contracts and everything like that, and they're the ones that sponsored the taking of the Klondike Nugget up into Dawson. But to go back to myself, I was born in Seattle, Washington, in May the 2nd, 1890. And my father and mother were both born in Ohio, and they heard about the West, to go West to everybody, because there's big doings out there, so they followed the railroad. They worked on the Great Northern Railroad that was being built going into Seattle, and mother was a cook for a tie crew, and my father worked on the ties. And he was, when he was a young man in Ohio, His father was a Baptist minister, and he was the third one of 13 children. And in those days, by the ministers, they lived more or less out of what they called the charity barrels, because the ministers weren't like they are today. They didn't have a regular salary or anything like that. They had to live off what the parishioners could give them, and they were clothed from these charity barrels, and never was enough shoes to go around. My father remembers going to school with gunny sacks tied around his feet because there weren't enough shoes for him to wade in the snow to school. So when he was about 10, 12, 13 years old, he was put out to a farmer. They took him in to give him room and board, and when he was 15, he worked there when he was 15, and he ran away when he was 15, and he went into a little town called Leesburg. And he got a job in what they call the Leesburg Press or something like that. Then he worked, and he was so interested in the printing business, he learned it from every bit of it, from just a little funky boy up to setting type, and then on up into where he was old enough that he could become a partial editor. And so then he had a chance to buy into what they called the Leesburg Buckeye. It was a little newspaper that was had been started, and they were having a little difficulty, so he went into that. So it was his interest in this and thinking he could go west and start a newspaper in the western coast. So they, being just a young couple, why, they started out. And mother stopped off in Ellensburg to have her first child, my brother Thane Thurston Hickman. He was born in Ellensburg, Washington in 1888. And so then after she was able to travel, why, she came on to Seattle. And at that time, housing was very short in Seattle. They couldn't, I don't know just why, there weren't very many buildings and everything. And my father had quarters over in Chinese Laundry, where he was living up over at Chinese Laundry on 1st and Bell Street, if you all know where 1st and Bell is now. And when mother came to join him, why, he put her up there. Well, then in 1889, mother stood at the windows there and watched his printing plant burn up. He became interested. I'm a little ahead of my story. He became interested in a printing company called the Old Sunset Printing Company, and they were the first state printers of Seattle. They printed the first state papers of Seattle, and So when they had the big fire of Seattle, it went down, of course, swept across the waterfront. It was down on what they called the Front Street. That was the same as Elliott Avenue down in Seattle at that time. And when the fire swept through, of course, it took his whole plant, too. But they saw it coming. So he and his partners, they took the presses and the paper and everything, and they loaded them on a big barge out in the bay. And evidently, in loading it, and they done in a hurry, why, a big wave come along and washed over the barge and tipped it, and everything went off after all the work, why, everything went off in the bay. But Dad never gave up, and he kept on working with the newspaper work, and then he got interested in this Metropolitan Printing and Binding Company. And so I was born, I wasn't in a hospital, I didn't go to the hospital, and I was born in this little room up over the Chinese Laundry on May 2nd, 1890. So Dad, after he was in this Metropolitan Printing and Binding Company, why, they heard about the great strike up in Alaska. So he talked his partners into sending him up on a survey to see if it would be feasible to start a newspaper up there. And so his partners, they talked it over, and in 1897, I guess it was in early part of November 1897, when my father started out, and he wanted to see which was the most feasible and best way to get up there. And so he went in up over the Chilkoot Pass. He climbed the Chilkoot Pass and went on into Dawson, and he found that it was a booming place, and there's going to be more. There was hectic, all kinds of excitement up there, and he thought that'd be a wonderful place for to start a newspaper. So he went down, and he got home just in time to spend Christmas with us in 1898, but anyway, he got down to spend Christmas with that year, and in 1897. And so then he started, and he got told the partners what had happened. And when he did come down, he went over the Chilkoot Pass to go into Dawson. Then he came down on the White Pass to see which were the most feasible way and best way to take the paper in. So they decided that the White Pass would be the way to take it up, because it wasn't so steep. It was a longer route and would take longer, but it wasn't quite as steep as going up over the Chilkoot Pass. And from his experience up there, why, he learned how to dress, he learned what would be the best clothing, and he got all the data on what that he would need to take this outfit up. And so then they got together, and I remember when a girl there, he got dogs. He had 10 dogs tied up in our yard, and those dogs would have a fight, and he'd load all his kids on the sled, and he'd holler gee and haw and drag the sled around on the dry streets to break these dogs in to take them up over the trail. And so finally, why, he got everything ready, and they were ready to sail from Seattle. So on the way up, while they were working hard and getting going on up over the trail, they finally heard that there was another newspaper that was coming up over the Chilkoot Pass, and they were pretty well heartbroken, but they thought maybe they could get up there and get the paper first. So anyway, the Klondike Nugget was established and was near ready to print on June 16, 1898. It was a little 17 by 11 inch, and it was four papers, and it was a weekly. That was the size of the paper. It was 11 by 17 inches, and it was four pages, and it was a weekly. But a little later, they tried it as a daily, but that didn't work, so they had to go back to a semi-weekly. And on May the 6th, in 1899, Zack F. Hickman was general manager, and Gene Allen was business and advertiser, and George Allen was editor overall. A.F. George was the city editor. Art Buell, you've all heard a lot of Art Buell, the artist. He was the artist and the cartoonist for the paper. And so in 1899, my father decided that it wasn't what he thought it was going to be, and so he decided to pull out. But to go back to this other paper, the Dawson Daily News, or whatever they call it, had started, and it was established on June the 14th in 1898, and was discontinued in 1907 or 1908. Both papers appeared on the streets of Dawson on the same day, and it has since been disputed which came out first. The A.V. Art Buell, the artist, a cartoonist later, lived in Sacramento, and he was on the Sacramento Bee as the artist, and his belief was that the sun came out about 3 1/2, the midnight sun, Yukon Sun paper had come out about 37 1/2 minutes before the Klondike Nugget. But my father and his partners, they all claimed that they had the nugget out of an hour or so before the other. So there's a dispute right now. It never was settled which came out first, but I kind of think my dad was right. I don't know. And to make the plates for Art Buell's drawings and everything, why, they had to, there wasn't enough metal for them, so they had to collect old butter iron and old ammunition and stuff, to collect that to make the plates for his cartoons. Had to go through all that, and for his pictures and all. And then Robert Service and Sam Dunham, and there was a Mr. Duncan. They were all contributors and wrote for the Klondike Nugget. And when they first come out, I don't know how he ever changed it. When they first come out, they spelled the Klondike. I know my father did in the first papers we had. It had K-L-O-N-D-Y-K-E, the Klondike Nugget. How they really got it, D-I-K-E, I just don't remember. Do you know when they transferred? I never did know that, no. And so then Gene Allen, this was his book. He wrote a book in 1935, I think it was, and he wrote up, he didn't write it, but he gave material to Russell A. Bankson, who wrote up the book, and in the book, it's all full of discrepancies. He takes the lead of taking this Klondike Nugget into Dawson. He's the manager, he's the whole works, but we have papers and proof that it was otherwise. So my mother wouldn't have this book in the house because it's nothing but fibs and all, but I thought maybe you might like to look through it. And when Dad was getting ready to go in up over the up the trail the first time, why, he wanted a picture of his family. So Mother couldn't see him carrying a picture with him up, but this picture in the front of the book, I'll pass it around, is the family taken in 1897. And so that he would have his family with him. At that time, they were making celluloid buttons. So my mother had the foresight to have this button made for my father to carry with him when he went up over. And it's all marked and battered, you can see that, but the pin was broken off. So I took it down to Frederick Nelson's and they put in this little frame to preserve it for me. So I'll pass that around, and here's a picture of the old crew, some of the crew at the Klondike Nugget. And the one here, the clean-shaven man here at the left on the one picture, is my father standing there, and this is their crew. And so I'll pass these around if anybody would like to look at it. And that book's out of print, the Klondike Nugget. One can't be found anywhere. I have a cousin, her name is Dorothy Brandt Brazier. Maybe you've seen some of her writing in she had the woman's page in the Seattle Daily Times for a long, long time. She was a cousin, and her father went in. He's mentioned in the book there. He went in with my father when they took the Klondike Nugget in. And she'd never seen or heard of that book, so it wasn't too well publicized, I guess, until she saw my copy when she visited me in Seattle. And she tried all over. She couldn't find a copy anywhere. And so she went to the Shorey's bookstore, and they put out a search, and took them 6 months before they could find a copy for her. And they told her that that was the last available copy they could find anywhere, because it was been out of print for so long. And I don't think I got a copy at the university or not. Do you have one at the Klondike Nugget University? But anyway, that was the story of the Klondike Nugget. And it's been changed since then a half a dozen times. Let's see here. It says that, I thought I had it written down here, but it was when this Gene Allen, he was forced out of Dawson. He was crooked. Gene Allen, by the way, was a ne'er-do-well. His brothers, George Allen and Plenty Allen, and there was one of the three Allen boys, two Allen boys, were my father's partners in this Klondike, in this Metropolitan Printing and Binding Company. And the Gene Allens were next-door neighbors to us. I used to play with his son Earl when we were small children, and he never had his children. They didn't have enough to eat in the house. His brothers took care of him. He was a ne'er-do-well. He never, his brothers had to carry him through. So they sent him on this trip with my father, thinking to make a man of him. And so after Dad had died and everything, and my mother never could find my father's diary, she swears up and down, his notes in this book are my father's diary, but I don't know, I wouldn't swear to that, but Mother always said that was so. But anyway, he wrote this book after Dad was gone, and so as I say, my mother wouldn't have the book in the house, but it's a good souvenir, and it does have some good copies of the old papers. And out at the university, I gave the university the only copy I had of my father's paper, and it was, I wrote down here what date it was. I gave the university a copy of Volume 1, Number 8. It was dated July the 16th, 1898. And that was the one I gave to the university in 1967. So if any of you want to look and verify that my father was the manager and everything of the Klondike Nugget, look up that paper at the university. And that's, they have it on microfilm, I understand, out there. Have you seen it, Mr. Cashin? Uh-huh. And it's a copy of Volume 1, Number 8. And that's the only one that I have ever seen or owned that does have my father's name on. So I don't know why Mother and Dad moved around so much, and they lost much of their material by moving so much. And my mother moved out and left Dad in 1908. And to go back to myself, why, my brother came up in 1907, and he worked out here on the Chattanooga Light Company out in Chattanooga, and crossing the ice in May 1908, why, he went through the ice and was drowned. And the folks had left me in Seattle because they thought that wasn't any place for a teenager that time. It was rough up here. But he had brought my mother and sister up in 1907. And so when my brother was crossing ice, he was drowned in the Chattanooga River in May 1908. And so that's how come they sent for me. Mother wanted to go outside so bad, and Dad said, well, he didn't want her to go, and for a consolation, they sent for me to come up. So I came up all the way by boat up on the old Northwestern through the Unimak Pass, through the Aleutians there, and we went straight over to Nome, and they were out there for 3 days unloading. It was stormy, and then we went over to St. Michael's and unloaded there. They had the lighters come out and meet the boat and unload them, you know. And then at St. Michael, we had to wait there 13 days for the boat to come down the river, and we got the last boat from the in St. Michael to come up river. And they doubted whether the Susie that I came up on, and they doubted the Susie could make it or not because the river was so low. And but we finally, after in St. Michael about 13 days, the Susie finally came in, and they had to spend the night loading it. And then when we finally got on board at midnight and we started out, why, it stormed so that they had to anchor the old Susie out in the bay there, and they took the lighters and all back to the docks, and I don't know where they put those, but anyway, they had to separate because on account of the storm. So finally the next day, why, they took the lighters out and fastened on to Susie. There was, or barges you'd call them, there was four of them. She had one on each side and two ahead, and it was the last boat of the season, so she was overloaded, and there wasn't many passengers. There was only two girls, just myself and another girl, and about six men were the only passengers on the boat coming up. And so we were the queens of the boat, really. And we stopped at every place. It took us a long while getting up because the old Susie had to stop at every little village to unload, you know. And we'd go ashore and walk around. And I forgot all the names. I didn't put that down because I didn't think that was part of the story on newspapers. But I just wanted you to know how I happened to come and get into Fairbanks. And when we got into the mouth of Yukon, after we left St. Michael and got the mouth of Yukon, why, the tide went out. They have that 48-hour tide there, and the tide went out, and there's five boats up high and dry in the mouth of the Yukon because they had all got, we did, there was the Little Reliance, the little boat was here, and there was the Nunavak, and the Isom. The big Isom was trying to get up to Dawson to winter up there, and the Susie, and I can't remember now what the other one was. I wasn't going to tell about this part, so I didn't make any notes on it, and I can't remember. But anyway, it was quite an experience to be up there high and dry. So a couple of the officers on the boat were going duck hunting. So this girl and I, we scrambled down into the boat, you know, a long dress is ankle length. We scrambled down this rope ladder into these boats, and we went around duck hunting. And then we went over to the Nunavak and the different boats to visit some of them there, and climbing, scrambling around up and down these ladders. And I forgot to say, when I was in St. Michael's, why, we were in the dining room, and a man came up, and he wanted to know which one of us girls was Clara Hickman. So when he knew I was, his name was Huey. And when you see some old photographs with Huey and Howland on them, why, that's this Mr. Huey. And so he took us girls all around and took pictures of us and parkas. And of course, I lost all those in the flood, which I did have. And he took pictures and all. And he was working his way on the Nunavak because he wanted to go up to Dawson and take pictures and then come down in the spring because he was just a professional photographer, you know. And so he was on the Nunavak. And so we went aboard and visited him again. Then when we got to Fairbanks, I forgot, 32 days from Seattle to Fairbanks. But now to go back to the Fairbanks papers, so I guess my main subject should be papers tonight, but I guess started talking, I kept rambling all over. But the first Fairbanks Daily News was established on September 19th in 1903 by George M. Hall and Frank Mason. And Frank Mason was the editor and printer, and R. J. McChesney was the manager until 1905. Then W.H. Raymond became manager and proprietor, and W.H. Raymond was the editor. Zach Hickman and Casey Moran were printers. They were printers for this company. George Bellows, who had a small sheet called the Tribune, put in with Hickman and Wilbur Ward to purchase the Fairbanks Daily News in 1906. Hickman to be editor and manager, Then Mr. Wilbur Ward sold his share to Hickman in 1907. Mr. W.F. Thompson, better known as Ron Funk Thompson, edited a paper called the Dome Miner, but he had been, off and on, had worked for the News. He had done a little editing and writing for the News, but he had this little paper he called the Dome Miner, but it came off the News Press. The Fairbanks Daily News printed the Dome Miner for Mr. Thompson. And then my father, Zach Hickman, and Mr. Thompson, they used to go down to Chena and get the news of the little town of Chena. I remember many times my father's come home with his whole head all swollen up from mosquito bites where they had to walk the railroad track. And he walked the railroad track down to Chena and back, and sometimes Thompson went with him. And then when my mother decided she wouldn't live here anymore and went outside, why, my father was despondent, so he sold the Fairbanks Daily News to W.F. Thompson. And this was in September in 1909, and that's when they made the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, because Thompson used his Dome Miner and had my father's combination of the Fairbanks Daily News. So that's how the Fairbanks Daily News Miner was born in 1909. And so I don't know if there's anything else that I should add to that. Is that enough for you, or do you want anything more?
You're the famous writer for the Genesis Daily, is that correct?
I do write. I don't know how famous, but I do try writing a little poem for Jess and Jess.
It's a lot of fun. The paper that, to whom did your dad sell?
He sold out to W.F. Thompson. They call him Ron Funk Thompson, you know. He
so
was
he had the
Dome Miner.
Dome
Miner. D-O-M-E, Dome Miner. There's a little dome mining town, you know, over
Dome City.
Dome City, yeah, huh? And this little paper was to represent, he called it the Dome Miner after this Dome City. But it was printed, the Fairbanks Daily News printed miner. Mm-hmm, yeah. And I think Dad's paper had the first beauty contest or whatever, popularity contest. Because I remember Daphne Moody, the old Moody family was here. She won it and sent on a trip outside, this Daphne Moody. Do you remember, Frank, they had a contest? Mm-hmm. And maybe you'd like to know, I was married to Jess Rust. I met him when I first came to Fairbanks. My mother, they wasn't bath houses around like they are now. You know, they had to go to a public bath house. You didn't have bathrooms in your homes. You had to go to a public bath house because so few homes had baths, just the ones around town that could get the city in running water. And they hadn't figured out then everybody having their individual wells yet for a while. So anyway, there was about four or five bath houses here, and you'd pay 50 cents for a bath, and you paid 25 cents extra if you took their towels, or you could take your own towel. And where the Oddfellows Hall is now, I don't know if many know this or not, that was built as a bath house and a health center, a clinic. And Jess's mother, Cora Madol, and Dr. Overgaard, they built what's called the Oddfellows Hall now. That was built in early 1907. And turned it into a clinic and a bathhouse, and they ran that. So she used to advertise in my father's paper, and through the advertising, my mother would go there for her death. So my first bath in Fairbanks, I took down there. And we had to walk down through the snow about 8-9 blocks and then walk home again. And so this this woman had a cute little picture on the wall, a pretty picture of a man and a woman. I could see it was her, you know, and I wondered, my mother had this picture on the wall, and I asked her who was the couple was there. She said, "Oh, you'll meet her," said she runs the bathhouse down here, and that's her son, Jess. And my sister spoke up, and she said, "Don't you, you can't steal him away from me because he's my brother." And so come to find out that when my brother had died, my sister used to be down at the bathhouse quite a bit because it was a good place for my mother and father to park her when they would go to dances and things at night and didn't want to leave her alone. So they'd leave her down there. And so this night, Jess was a prospector, and also he hunted for the market. At that time, you could sell sheep and moose to the market. So he would hunt for the market in the winter, and then he'd prospect in the summer, and also he hoisted in some of the mines. But at this time, he had been out hunting. And the first night I went down to the bathhouse, he wasn't there. But the next time we went down, my sister and I were each in a tub, and they had these two or three tubs in a row, you know, and they had a partition between, but they just put off the floor and about 2 feet from the ceiling so the air could circulate through, you get the heat off through. And so my sister and I were in these tubs, and we heard voices in the front, you know. My sister hollers, "Oh, there's my brother, there's my brother," and she jumps out of the tub, and I don't think she even dried herself, and so she ran in front, and of course I didn't want to take my time because I wanted to look halfway decent to meet this fellow I'd heard so much about, you know. And so anyway, I don't know if I should tell this story or not, but anyway, when I come out into the other room, you know, I was always big. At that time I weighed 201 pounds, and of course I was young, but my hair was plastered down, and I always was such a red face person, you know, my face was rosy and red, you know, and I know I looked a sight. And so we spoke very formally. Of course I was more or less overconscious, you know, conscientious about meeting him the first time, because it seemed like he had been questioning a lot and been interested in my coming in, because at that time there weren't too many girls around Fairbanks, single girls. So anyhow, and when we got home, and my mother had heard that I had met Jess, well, she's all curiosity, you know. So she had to call down to Mrs. Madole, and she said, "What did Jess think of Clara?" And she said, "Well, I'm not going to tell you." Mm-hmm. And so mother coaxed and coaxed, you know, and finally, she said, "Oh, no, he didn't," like that. And I thought, well, what now? So mother finally, I got out of her and said, "What a big fat slob." So he was very disappointed in seeing me. So I was provoking that at him, and several times he called and he wanted to come up and he wanted to make a date, you know, and I wouldn't. And so finally the big Thanksgiving dance was coming up, and it was the Eagles dance. They had the main big dance of the year, the Eagles did those early days, because they had the big hall, and it was pretty nicely fixed up and everything. And so one night while we were home, and we heard talking out, and up the back path came Jess and his mother, and they came in, and I wasn't, if I could have hid, I would have gone someplace or other. But anyway, before he left, I'd promised to go to the Eagles dance with him. And so I didn't have any dresses. My boss, Mary Anderson, dragged to the store while she picked out a dress for me. And of course, it was long. We all wore long dresses then. I had a black taffeta dress, real full skirt and short puff sleeves. And oh, I was all dressed up, my first formal, you know. And so we went to the dance. And after that, that was it. After that, I knew Jess had to be mine. That's all there was to it. So then we were married. We became engaged. We went together about a year, and then we were engaged and married in 1910. So it might be interesting to know we had white grouse meat for our wedding supper. We had white grouse meat for our wedding supper. It was a private wedding and quiet, huh?
Now, those things are interesting. Now, you spoke about the market hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Surely this is something that many people don't know about, and why don't you tell us something about market hunting in Fairbanks?
Well, he had a dog team, and he would go out into the woods, and he went up where he could get sheep. That would be up toward the rapids up in that way, and up on up toward Lavengood, up in the beaver country up there, the sheep up in there. And he'd go up in there and get sheep and bring down for the market, and he sold so much per pound to the public markets. Moose and sheep, and I don't know whether he made really much on it, but it was a living, I guess, and getting out. He was an outdoors man. He just, ever since he was a child, he was raised in Butte, Montana, and they used to go up in the hills what falls, there's some falls up there that
Great
he was...
Great Falls.
Great Falls? No, the head of some falls up there that his father used to go up to hold claims for some company, and he spent the time around hunting rabbits and things in the woods, so he always was interested in hunting. And so that's what came naturally to him. And then he hoisted, it might be interesting to know that he hoisted for all these great big miners, Wagner out here on, out for up above Engineer Creek, and there was another another miner called, I wish the things didn't slip my mind like that, Ed and, can't think of his name, but anyway, all these big old miners out there, he never hoisted for the Berry Brothers, but he hoisted for Wagner and...
Will you explain though, what you mean by hoisted?
Oh, don't you know that? Well, that's the boarder house.
I do, but
maybe some of the others don't know.
No, we don't.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, they would have a boarder house on all the claims. They would have a boarder house or a hoist house, a boarder house and a hoist house. And sometimes the hoist house would be combined in the boarder house. And the hoist is, they had a large donkey engine with the cable, and it would run they had a line that would run up to, the cable would run from the drum on the boiler up to a gin pole, and then drop down into the hole. There would be some kind of a dolly, I think they called it, over the hole, that this cable would go down into the hole to bring the buckets up. And then on the hole side of the gin pole, there was a trip up there. And they would hoist it. He would run, when they would give him the signal, he would run the engine, and it would wrap this cable on the drum, you know, and bring the bucket up to the top and out of the hole and then up to the gin pole. And then the trip would trip it on there. And usually the miners in the wintertime, they would build up these big dumps in the wintertime. They'd build them up. And they had them built over sluice boxes, you know. Some of them built their dumps right over a sluice box, and then others built them alongside. And they would, in the spring, just as soon as it started to thaw, as fast as they could thaw the dump, why then they would shovel the dirt into the sluice box. So he ran these hoists, and one time he was hoisting out two holes at once, Henry Wagner and, I wish I could think of this other man's name, you might have heard his name too around mining. He hoisted for these two men because their holes were so close together. And but he said it just about drove him nuts because it was just almost too much. And they had a signal. If the bucket coming up, they ring one bell. And that's a bucket of dirt. They would ring one bell. And if it's a man coming up, they would ring two bells. And if it's more than one man, then they would ring three bells. Because quite often, why, there'd be some reason or other that some man was going to come up. I remember just at one time, there was some smart alecky guy there, and... he came up without ringing the bell, and he dumped him out up on the dump. And he said the man came in, and he was raising canes. You could see me there, you darn fool. Jeff said, you didn't give the signal. And he said, I didn't see it till he fell off. And because often he doesn't watch the, you know, and so he dumped him out. And but it must have been really interesting. I know we went mining on our first year of marriage. We went mining up on 5 above Little El Dorado Creek. And we had to put down a 185-foot hole up there. And we put it down during the winter time, and we were lucky enough to get three men that had been living on the creeks and had no job. And just for the room and board, you won't get anybody to do that nowadays, but just for the room and board, they came and helped put the hole down, the three of them. And we gave them room and board, and they lived in a bunkhouse that was already on the ground. And then in the spring, if you make good, then you pay them. Otherwise, why, you're nothing lost. But they expected wages in the spring. And so we worked and put this down, and I used to go out with Jess, and we cut what they call lagging. At first they started the hole down, they made it like you do a cabin, squares, you know, put the log this way, and made squares. Then after they get down about 3 or 4 feet, then they call what they have lagging. They put it in a square and saw down another square, and then behind the squares they hammer down these poles. The poles are lengthways behind these squares, and they do that as they go down. They saw so many feet. And then put a square in, and then down, and then they put these poles down. And they did that for 185 feet. And I know I was curious, and I wanted to go down and see where they were working down there. So I got in the old bucket and rode down that 185 feet. And boy, it was scary. I didn't like it very well. And the fellows
so
would be...
all frozen all the way down?
Frozen all the way down. Mm-hmm.
And build fires on the top?
Had points. We had points. We had a butter house, and we had points. And they thawed it with the hot water, You know, they, at the company, did most of their thawing with cold water, but we didn't know about cold water thawing then.
What about the oxygen, Mrs. Ruff?
Well, it's just from the hole down. And then they had a pipe go down. They had a pipe go down for air, a pipe in the corner of the shaft. There's a pipe went down for air. But it wasn't too good. They had to, but they worked with pretty long shifts. And they had carbide lamps. They had these funny little carbide lights on there, on here. And, but before Jess and I were married, I had gone out, his mother and I had gone out to see where they were mining out there and spend my vacation out there. And that was, we were married in October 25th, 1910. And this about in July we went out there. And the boys, there was a big old shaft full of water, which miners had been there before. And they knew this shaft was there, and they knew there was a spring there, because this water was alive in this shaft. All the old shafts around it had been pretty well drained. But this one was full of water, and they knew it was alive because of the way the ice worked on it, you know, in the winter before. So anyway, they thought they could build a bedrock drain. And so they spent practically the whole summer building this bedrock drain. It went way down the creek, and they started the drain up to see if they could drain this hole. And finally it was beginning to get cold, and they saw they weren't going to get that drain done. But toward the end, to work in the drain, they got so that they couldn't go up the open cup. So they went in the neighbors. There's a miner there called Fraker and Nelson. It was Otto Nelson, you probably heard of him, and Sherman Fraker. And they had the ground next to ours, and they had a deep shaft. So they let our boys, they went down in, and Jess and his two partners, they would go down in Fraker's mine and go to the end of one of their tunnels toward where this old shaft was, and they started to dig in to see if they could meet this, bedrock drain that they had started to build to work, and they started shoving that down to see if they couldn't meet the one they had been working on from the outside, you know, the open cut. So anyway, why? Being curious, you know, I just had tried to get me two or three times to go down, because I couldn't figure what they were doing down there, you know, and I'd never been in a mine before. And so I got rigged one day, and he put boots on me, and I got an old slicker on and climbed in the bucket and went down with him. I didn't know what I was up against. I never would have gone, because when we got to the end, there was a hole in the wall, just a hole in the wall at the end there, you know, and he says, crawl through there. I said, what? And he said, you have to crawl through there. And I said, oh, I'm not going to, well, you come this far, you have to go through. So that was the hole that they crawled through to work on the other side. They're just like gophers down there. And so I started to crawl through, and big old fat me, I didn't get in the hole. I got in, but I couldn't go clear through. So Jess gives me a shove, and I land through on my face on the other side. And for their buckets, they had, like, you see pictures of old coal buckets, you know, with the wheels on them, you know, and big wooden things, like big wooden square thing. Anyway, why, that was what they were hauling the dirt with when they were running this tunnel, you see. And so when I went through, they had slats, flat pieces of board that they would run this thing on so it wouldn't go down to the mud. So he put me in that and took me up to where they were working at the head of the tunnel. And I was didn't enjoy it very much, because I was worrying so much more about how I was going to get back through that hole again. But I got through it. And so when I think of all the things that Jess put me through and the way he talked to me and all, I don't know why I ever married him then. But he was a wonderful guy. And it shows the kind of man he was, because we'd been going together for a year, and I kept waiting for him to say something, though I wasn't thinking too much about it. And when my mother and father, my mother left with my little sister, she was about 9 years old. And when they left with her, why, Beth said to us, I was quite embarrassed, because we're all sitting there, you know, and come time to say goodbye. And she spoke up and said, I'll bet a dollar this boat won't anymore get around the corner, and you and Jess will get married. And she was really provoked, you know, and Jess said, well, that gives me an idea, he said. So that fall, well, then he did propose, but then I had come home from work, and I went to living with his mother after my mother had gone and our home had broke up, and I was living with his mother. And I stayed with him at the back house until it froze up, and then she had a little cabin in back. That cabin still stands there. It's there on 2nd Avenue, right near Cowell's. There's a little cabin in the front of it. It's right on the street, and there's a little window up front. And at that time, there was quite a big garden in front. Mother had a garden there, and there was a fence across and a porch on this house. Well, anyway, that's where I was staying with her. So I was home this noon, and Jess had come in from the Cricks, and he said, I want to talk to you a minute. So we went in and sat down, and he says, hold out your hand. And so I put my hand out, and he put this ring on my finger. That was in 1909. And I said, what's that for? Well, he said, if you don't know, I'm sure as hell not going to tell you.
Yeah.
So that was how I became, that's the kind of man I met.
That
was
a romantic.
That was a very romantic engagement, I tell you. But I've always loved my little ring, and I hang on to it as if it was $1 million. And I've had about 4 different bands put on that I keep wearing out bands on. It's very thin now. It's ready for another band. But I wear it all the time, and I thought this was gorgeous ring.
Well, you've been in the Fairbanks area for a long time, and you didn't have an opportunity to steal hubcaps, and you probably didn't smoke marijuana in those days. Now, what did the youngsters do for mischief in the early 1900s?
Well, of course, I was a teenager then. I was 17 when I came in, and going on 18, and of course, I was at the age where I went to card parties and dancing and everything like that. And but like bringing up my own children, for they made their own fun. We didn't have anything like they have now, you know. Used to have tacky poles at home, and they would have parties, and they went skiing and skating and played in the yard, and they were just busy, and they belonged to the Girl Scouts and Campfire Girls, and they loved the woods, and they learned to swim. My daughter, when she was 14, Lala swam Birch Lake, clear across Birch Lake when she's 14, and that old cold water, and there was Campfire Girls out there at that time. Mrs. Robert Bloom, you probably heard of her, old Bob Bloom, or his wife had a group of Campfire Girls there, and Lala and my two girls were belonged to that. And so when they're out there, Lala and Virginia Rivers, that's Ralph Rivers' half-sister, they made a bet about, they were discussing who was the best swimmer and who could swim Birch Lake. And so they got Mrs. Bloom to row the boat, and Mrs. Bloom said that she bet she rowed around that lake 4 times because they wouldn't swim in a straight, you know, streak. She had time to follow them. And from where that little cabin was, used to call it Florence, it's right near Nearland's camp there. Well, they swam from that point across to where the Army camp is now. That was Rivers Point at that time. The Rivers owned a piece of ground over there. I think they still own a little bit. But anyway, those girls swam from there clear across over there. So after that, it was the goal of every one of my kids and every one of mine have swum that lake. And George, the boy, he dog paddled all the way across. He wouldn't give up, but he dog paddled all the way across that lake. So every one of them swum Birch Lake, and they think that's quite a feat. I know Epline was talking the other day. I happened to see him, I guess the Pioneer's doings, and he asked me if I remembered when he and Ben Hurler and Lala dared Ben Hurler to swim the lake. And because they were out there on a trip or something. And so Ben and Lala made it, but if turned back, he couldn't get very far. But Lala and Ben made it, and they made it from where our cabin is now, where our cabin is down there, you know, where Bobby Sheldon's cabin is on Birch Lake there. Well, anyway, they made it from about there over to the point of LaRue where the old road used to turn up over the hill. They made it across there.
Well, clearly, your father was an editor, and of course, you're writing in the present time for a newspaper. You've possibly done a lot of writing in the past. You've written several articles for the Alaska Sportsman, is this correct?
Oh, yes. I wrote this about being a bride on Little El Dorado. That was in 2 issues of the Alaska Sportsman. And also, I wrote about the early day telephone girls. And because I was a telephone operator for 9 years, I went night shift.
Why don't you tell us about the telephone operating on the early telephone system?
Well, in the early telephone system, we didn't have phones, but we didn't have phone books, you know. They would issue maybe one every 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so everybody
first,
was given a number.
First tell us where it started and where the central office was.
The central office was right where it's practically always been. They built a little place there on the back of the NC Company on the corner of 2nd and Turner. It was a little corrugated building there, and then they enlarged it in later years, and then finally, of course, it burned down. But anyway, the telephone operators, there was one day operator and one night operator, just 2 operators when they first started in. Then they began having the girls were on for 4 or 5 hours and off an hour or so for relief. And then, as I say, they didn't have phone books when wanted anybody to say, well, give me Tom Jones' residence or give me such and such. There was no numbers. But we operators, the operators, had to learn the numbers. You not only had to memorize this people's number, but their name as well and what they're, you know, on the switchboard. And at first it was just a very small switchboard, like a big PBX board. Then by the time I went there, they were just putting in a two-place board. Before that, they'd been one. But they had a little back room where they had the long distance. And at the early days, every crick had its long distance line. There was a operator in Dome Crick. There was one at Chattanooga, and one at not Fox, no, Dome and Chattanooga, and in Cleary, I believe. But anyway, they were had these operators, and they would be two girls, which they were just the queen of the cricks, because my land, they were
a shower to this. Operators.
One of the first ones was out on Cleary, or Dome Creek, was Cora Weir and her sister Lillian. They were the first ones out there. And then, of course, Margaret Brandt was one. She was on the night shift for years and years here. In fact, it was her place that I took. And I should remember some of the others. There was...
What was the name of the lady that died about a year ago? She was an telephone operator for the FAA, and 2 days after she retired at about the age of 72, she passed away.
Hmm.
That was Lillian.
Oh, Lillian Watson, yes.
Lillian
she
Watson.
Was in the Hill Building down there in Anchorage, and when I visited down there, she'd retired about three times, and they always called her back. Mm-hmm. And she was a wonderful operator. And in 10 or 11, I think it was, 1911, when they had the big strike down at Iditarod, they went down there, and they had a telephone, Henry Weir had the telephone company down there. And then about 1913, they came up to Fairbanks, and then Henry, because that had petered out, you know, and Henry Weir was the manager of the Fairbanks telephone company, and he was the manager for the many years. And my husband used to, when we went broke out there on, we were drowned out. I didn't tell that story, but that's another one again. We were drowned out there in Little El Dorado because they did hit, they put up some points in, and they did hit this shaft. And it drowned out, and the men barely got out of the hole in their lives. So Jess went down to the siding to come to town to look for work. And I had gone to cook for Fraser and Nelson, and so the men had gone their various ways that were working for us. So Jess was down there, and Paul Rickert, where the old Rickert subdivision was out here at 12th and Cushman, that you would never know had been a great big farm in there. Well, he had this farm, and still he was a lineman for the Fairbanks Telephone Company. And so he happened to be down there when Jess went down to catch the train to see if he'd get in town to look for work. He being an old Eagle member, and he was on the drill team with Jess with the Eagles, and he knew Jess had been a lineman. In his youth, Jess had been a lineman for the old Bell Telephone Company in Seattle, and he used to deliver telegrams for the Western Union Telegraph Company. But he had been a lineman for the Bell Telephone Company, and I guess in line of talking, Rickert being interested in the telephone in Fairbanks and all, Jess must have told him he'd been a lineman. So he hired Jess right then and there. He needed somebody on the creeks to help. They were doing some repair work on the telephone lines out to Chattanooga. And so then he got work right then. And from then on, he worked for the telephone company off and on. He was just on call, more or less. And then it was about 1912 when he first went to work steady and got a weekly wage from the NC company for working for the telephone and the NC company for troubleshooting and things like that. But anyway, to go back to the telephone operators, I had been working at a laundry, and Henry Weir, Mr. Preston, the manager of the NC company, he had talked to Mrs. Weir about a replacement for Mrs. Brandt, because Mrs. Brandt had gone to sleep a couple times at the switchboard. She'd been there so long, and she'd working so hard, and she had turkey houses and a big garden, and the night patrolman had come and found her asleep one night when people had tried to get her, and so they knew they had to get somebody else. So Henry Weir talked to his wife and Mr. Preston also, and Mr. Preston talked to Mrs. Weir and Henry, and they thought that I should go to work as a telephone operator because the laundry work was too hard. And when they first suggested it, I didn't see how it could ever be, because it looked so complicated, all these plugs and pulling this and that. And I sat one night and watched Mrs. Weir, and I said, oh no, I can never do that. I'd rather work in the laundry than do that. So I was over at washboard scrubbing on the washboard of the laundry, and it looked much easier than that telephone operating. And so anyhow, Mrs. Weir said, well, I'll make you up a book. So we made up, they made up books, you know. We had one book alphabetically for the names, like ABC and on through. were the names, and then we had another one going by numbers, and we had the names on the numbers so that we'd know what the telephone, how to call. We double check when we get someone that maybe a new one that we didn't know. So anyway, she said, "I've made up your book now for you, and you take home and you study it." And I forgot how long she said that she gave me that I'd be going to work. So this one day I was down at the laundry, and I got a call to go up the telephone. And it was Mrs. Weir, and she said, "You better go home and get some rest because you have to come to work at 10 o'clock tonight." I said, "Oh, no, I'm not near ready yet." Well, she said, "You have to start sometime." She said, "Mrs. Brandt went to sleep last night, and we've got to replace her tonight." And I just hated to take her place. I knew it hurt Mrs. Brandt's feelings. And so Mrs. O'Gara let me go home, and I put in my resignation, and I quit. That was Jack O'Gara's American Ham Laundry I was working at. And so I went to work that night, 10 o'clock, and I was just shivering in my boots, and I hated for Mrs. Weir to go and leave me. So I've been getting along pretty good, and I would check, and quite a few of the numbers I had learned, and of course, being in Fairbanks a long while, quite a few of the numbers I knew already. And finally, a fire alarm come in, and that about floored me. And when the fire alarms came in, why, you first had to call the fire department. You would plug in for the fire department. Then you would plug in for the NC boiler room because they had to blow the whistles and turn on the pumps, you see. And then whatever man was in charge, it was Jess, I'd have to call my husband. The whatever man was home that should be down there, you see. And Bill Hunter was on over at the boiler house. So I plugged in and I called Bill Hunter, you know. Then I called up to Jess and called about the fire. And I sat there waiting and I thought, and the fire was over at the hospital and supposedly. And waited, nothing happened. Pretty soon Bill Hunter called and he said, "Where in heck's that fire department? I haven't got a signal from him yet." Here in all my excitement, I forgot to call the fire department in all places. And so right away I called him. And when they got over there, well, it was just a furnace smoking, thank goodness. But just think what a din it had been, a fire. So that woke me up. After that, why, I never made a mistake again. And the funny part is, you know, when a fire would come in, why, the switchboard get red. You see, the NC would blow a long blast for whichever side of Cushman it was or something, and then short ones for the district, so everybody would know. But a lot of people didn't listen to the whistles, and so they would call in. And I learned that switchboard would be red. Every light on the board would be on, you know. And so I'd take my hand and push all the plugs open. I'd say, like, it's St. Joe's Hospital, St. Joe's Hospital. And then I'd pull them all closed, and then I'd do it again, you know, because the lights kept coming on. So that's the way we answered the fire calls. And sometimes there'd be a lost child. I remember one time there was a little girl lost, and so he blew the whistles, and everybody had phone in. There's a lost child. They'd go hunting for the child. And so we were kind of the pulse of the city, you might say. And I was there during the blackout when the war started. And, oh, what a hectic time that was. We had to walk to work with a flashlight, with a red flashlight on, you know. No, the town was all blackout. And it was real spooky. And we had to, minutely, you know, a siren would blow, we'd have to I'd have to leave the switchboard and put the blank, the boards at the window, you know.
Is that Second World War?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's kind of a deal. But it was interesting working in the telephone office. I enjoyed it. So these girls out on the creeks, you know, sometimes the old miner would come in, they would do favors for them and phone for things for them, orders and stuff. Like, they would bring them nuggets and pokes of gold, you know, for gifts. And I know Lillian Watson had all kinds of furs and things that the boys on the creek would give them. But of course, we in town, we never had anything like that, except Christmas time. You never saw so much candy. It was Sticky Griffin had a candy place here, and he had beautiful big boxes. And we have just candy, and big boxes of candy, and individual boxes. And then sometimes every operator was sent, we'd be sent back maybe half a dozen stockings or maybe a cut glass dish or something. We pretty near always would get the same things. But it was an interesting era. I'm very thankful that I was here to live through it. And I did enjoy the telephone work. And I worked nights went to work at 10 at night, and I worked till 8 in the morning for 9 years in the telephone office. So I got to know everything pretty much about
that. Did you work more than 9 years? Total?
I worked more than 9 years, but not the telephone office, no. I worked for 9 years the telephone office. I tell you, well, I did too, yes. I'm sorry to make a mistake there. I got a chance to work out at Ladd Field, and they needed a telephone operator out there, so I was one of the first women operators. And we started at Ladd Field with just a little bit of PDX board, and the time I left, I was there over a year. When I left there, they had the big one. But I made a very big mistake because I was very happy when I worked there. I liked it very much, and I was head operator, of course, and worked 8 hours. I went to work 8 in the morning. I had no more night shift, and I worked until 4:30 in the afternoon. It's always goes after 5 time I get bus and get home. But anyway, they were building the long distance phone between here and Seattle. And Captain Wooster, of course, was head in the ACS there in the federal building. And he was in charge of this. And so he came out to see me a couple times there. And he said, "You're the only one that we want. You're the person to come in and be our first operator for this line to the States." And he said, "We want an experienced operator and someone that knows the country and all." And he said, "We want you to transfer and come into town." And I didn't look into things enough because I didn't realize I was too dumb, I guess, to go about something. I didn't look into it to realize that that they were ACS and Ladfield was double ACS, you see. And I really couldn't transfer. I had to quit my job at Ladfield to take the job into there. Well, when I got in, I finally did. Jess told me, "Claire, you're making a mistake." He said, "You don't know Captain Wooster like I do. And he won't keep any of his promises," because he promised me I'd be head operator and I could make my own hours and I could hire my own help. I mean, I could pick out my own operators to work with me. And he gave a big song and dance, and I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. So when I got in there, well, of course, it was all Army. I couldn't do any of these things. I wasn't any. I was just nobody. I was just a little rock in a little puddle or something like that. And so when I'd set up the hours and all, why, the sergeant in charge, he changed it all around. And they were very disappointed to have a big old fat grandma like me to be the operator. They wanted a nice young girl there. So they were nasty to me. They weren't a bit cooperative at all. And so one night there, why, there was one of the boys, and I don't mind mentioning it now because he's, maybe I should, but anyway, Harry Reimer was one of the boys there. And he had been out in the woods, and he had picked a lot of birch bark, and he had made a lot of pretty little Christmas cards. And I was writing cards because it wasn't too busy. And, you know, you worked out, gone to work at midnight, you see, and worked till morning. We had to change shifts, you know. And so I was working on these Christmas cards, and he said, "Gosh," he said, "I didn't get enough envelopes." He said, "I would like some more envelopes to get all these cards out." So I said, "Well, I have a big box of cards here. You can go through them and pick out." Being me, wanted to help, knowing that they didn't like me very well. And I thought, well, I'd be just a little helper. And so I let him go through and pick out the envelopes that would fit his cards. And so then about 4 or 5 days later, a week later, I was called up to Mr. Wooster. And he said, "How come that you have put down that you worked a certain shift when the other girl had worked?" And I said, "Well, she didn't work that night." And he said, "Well, it's right down, and she claims she did." And I said, "But she didn't." I said, "I worked that night." I said, "Call Harry Reimer, and he can tell you, because he worked with me, and I gave him envelopes for his, that would, to bring it to his memory. I gave him envelopes for these birch bark cards." And so he called Harry in, and Harry denied it. He said, "No, I didn't work that night." He said that he didn't remember. He said he was sure I didn't work that night. So he lied. And so I got mad, and then I quit. I told Jess, I said, "I can't take anymore, I'm going to quit." So I wrote in my resignation, and I took it in to Mr. Wooster. And the next night, when I was getting ready, I told him I was going to quit within a certain day, you see. So the next night, when I was getting ready to go to work, I was going to work at midnight or something like that. But anyway, I was getting ready to go to work, I get a notice, like the telegraph boy brought up a notice to me, that I was fired. So I got fired before I could quit. It went and so I fired. So actually, I had no use for Harry Reimer, and I had no use for Mr. Wooster. But that's ended my telephone operations from then on. And I tried to get back to Ladfield, and they were mad at me out there because it was a Captain Goodwin. He was the head, and he was awfully nice. And he tried his best. He said, "You won't be happy in there." And he said, "It can't be all that he told you, because I know the Army." He said, "You're making a mistake to go in." And he tried to talk me. I just thought it was going to be so wonderful, be the first operator to talk over the line. And I was sitting at the switchboard one day, then I got a telephone call, and he told me it was Captain, oh dear. Anyway, he was out in Washington, D.C. And he said, first I got a call, and he said it was from, they had the central station, I think it was in Denver, Colorado, where they had the main stationed at that time to between there and Washington, between us and Washington, D.C., and putting in these lines. And I had the call from this operator, and he said, "Are you very busy, operator?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And he said, "This is Fairbanks, Alaska." And I said, "Yes, it is." He said, "Have you got time to talk for a few minutes?" And it was Colonel Roberts. He said, "Have you got time to talk for a few minutes?" And I said, "Well, yes, it all depends." And he said, "Well, we have Colonel Roberts in Washington, D.C. He wants to talk to Fairbanks, be the first one talking over this long line." Mm-hmm. And so he did, and we had quite a talk. He wanted how long I was in Alaska, and so we were the first ones to really talk to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. over this line that goes outside now.
What year was that?
That was in 1942, when the line was finished going down. They built it in a hurry, you know, just like we built the highway. It followed the highway.
I see.
It followed, it came right along after the highway. Yeah. So that ended my telephone career.
Well, you've been in the field of communication, haven't you?
Oh, yes, I've been about everything.
And telephones and communications. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Mm-hmm.
What did you say Jeff's mom's house was? I wonder if
you said
still
that?
There.
Huh?
You said Jeff's mom's house
was
still
next. Yes, that's the house. It's that little house back of Oddfellows Hall. You know where Oddfellows Hall is, facing First Avenue. It's a little house right directly in back, a little log house there. There's no porch on it now. But at that time, I have pictures of myself on the porch there, a little porch across the front there. Uh-huh. And it's right there. There's a house right on the corner of Second and Cowles, a kind of a white, clappered house, a star and a half house, yes. And it's right in back of that. And that was her house. That was her private home before they built the bathhouse, and she rented that out. And this is kind of interesting because Jimmy Barrett comes into this because he was just a greenhorn kid here. He'd just come up to join his father. And it was in the winter of 1909. Yes, the winter of 1909, Jess would, when he come to town, this Dr. Overgaard didn't know much about pipes and stuff, so whenever Jess come to town, he used to say he had to come to town because they were always had a lot of work for him to do. He had to repair pipes and do boiler work and all stuff like that. And Jess seemed to just come natural by doing all these things. And this time, some pipe or something had froze up, and they had leased or were buying their plant, their boiler plant. They were leasing that from the Sampson Hardware Company, which it was Bumble, Hamilton, and Kellogg at that time. And the Barracks his uncle was one of the partners, Jimmy Barrack's uncle. And I don't know where his dad come in. But anyway, he had just come in from the outside from college. And bathhouse people, Jess's mother and her partner, had bought these boilers, but they're paying for them. They hadn't got everything paid for yet, you see. And so the Sampson still had, I guess, owned them. I don't know how they do in a deal like that. But anyway, they had trouble, and I think a pipe froze up or something. So they had phoned over to the barracks because they were supposed to the Sampson company. They were supposed to take care of the plant. When anything, Jess wasn't there to do it, by then they phoned over to them. So they sent Jimmy over. And Jimmy knew nothing about it, so he pulled this pipe and that pipe, and he did something, and he went off and left something disconnected there. And before the night was over, it was about 35 below, and before the night was over, they were froze up. And of course, they couldn't do anything. They couldn't sue because it wasn't their plant, so they're out of business. And so then we moved over into her little house, and I stayed with her. Yeah. And that was, they put them out of business, because it was through this greenhorn kids not taking care of the pipe, but of course you couldn't anything do about it because they owned barracks, you know, they owned all the material there. So that's the end of that.
Do you have any more questions?
Being the first of the newspaper deal with Barrack talking, Bob, I brought some old newspapers and I thought maybe you might to look at
them. Oh, that'd be wonderful. Uh-huh,
I think it would take too long to pass them around and read them, but I'll read you the.
Oh, yeah. Would you like to sit here? Do you want to
No, that's just fine. Make yourself comfortable. Mm-hmm. Well, Clara, your talk has been most interesting. We appreciate it very, very much.
Mm-hmm. I talked about everything else, but newspapers...